C-SPAN's year-long History First Lady's Influence and Image featured interviews with more than 50 preeminent historians and biographers. In the new book, First Ladies, these experts paint portraits of all 45 First Ladies, their lives, ambitions, and unique partnerships with their presidential spouses. Susan Swain and the C-SPAN team listed the details that made these women who they were. Susan Swain was the moderator for C-SPAN's special year-long history series, First Ladies, Influence, and Image. She is also C-SPAN's co-CEO, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Susan Swain to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us.
So glad to be with you and your listeners.
Very nice to have you here. How did this whole project get started?
Well, we are about 3 years plus into this project, and we were lobbied, I guess, in a very friendly way by a historian whom we've worked with so often over the years, Richard Norton Smith, who himself has written several presidential biographies and has been the executive director of 5 different presidential libraries over the years. He had been doing some work on the First Ladies and got very excited about the stories that they had to tell. And he kept coming back to us because we've done several special history projects saying, C-SPAN really ought to look at these women. They're really incredibly interesting. So we eventually caved and said, okay, we'll look at them. And we agreed with him. We put together a panel of 3 other academic advisors who were specialists in the First Ladies, brought in the White House Historical Association as our special partners, and they gave us access to their archives, and then we were off and running on this wonderful project that started on television at President's Day 2013, and we ended a year later in President's Day 2014. Then I immediately began work on the book that you have in your hands.
Right. And you wanted to go in chronological order. That was always the intent.
It was the intent because choosing among them, which people often do in collections of First Ladies, leaves a lot of the interesting stories on the table. And our premise in both the television series and in the book is that these women, many of whom have fallen to the dustbin of history, have interesting stories to tell about their own lives and about the history of the nation and also about the history of women in the nation.
Why do you think it is, just to follow up on what you just said, of why so many of these women have fallen into the dustbin of history?
Well, for many of them, they were at a time when it was not appropriate for women to be interviewed by the newspapers of the time. So unless they left extensive written records, we don't have very much history to go on. Their husbands' stories were told while women were really not thought of as appropriate subjects for public examination. I mean, one of my amazing stories is the story of someone who wrote an 800-page biography and, in fact, never mentioned his wife. And do you know which president that is?
I do not.
Well, Van Buren, who I guess appropriately the historians say that that would be logical for a public figure of the time.
Okay.
That they really would speak of their own accomplishments, but not of their wives.
Now, what is fascinating about this is that the stories themselves are often so incredible that it's hard to believe that they would be relegated to the sideline.
Yes, but we move on, and I mean, I really loved the fact that we were able to bring some of them back to life again. For example, in her day, Frances Cleveland, who was known as Frank, not Frankie, but Frank, was the first real celebrity First Lady. She was enormously popular in her time. She eliminated the bustle in women's dresses as she was a real fashion maven in her age. But we know virtually nothing about her today. And it was really delightful to be able to tell her story. You will remember her husband is the only non-sequential twice elected president. And after their first term was over, she said to the people who were moving them out of the White House, leave all the draperies as they are. We'll be back in 4 years. And she was right. They were.
Of course, you start with Martha Washington. And as you point out in the series and in the book, she really set the standard of how First Ladies would behave and what their duties would be for a century later.
That's right. Our historians tell us that Martha Washington and General Washington were enormously cognizant of precedent setting and that what they were doing would be followed for generations. And it was things that seem maybe to our ears today trivial, but were so enormously important symbolically to the new nation. There was a great debate about how the president and his wife would be addressed. Should it be their excellencies? The Washingtons decided that they wanted much more democratic titles. She would be Lady Washington, which was appropriate at the time. She also instituted a regular open session. They were called levees in her day, where people could come in and interact with them face to face. How very democratic that was for the very first president and their wives. And this tradition of weekly levees, which she had at the Executive Mansion, was carried on for quite a long time throughout the generations. Martha Washington also started the idea, although we think of it as a modern one, of having a particular cause. Her cause was the soldiers in the Revolutionary War. She became a mother figure to them, our historians say. She, and this is another sign of her thinking about the democracy that was evolving. Women of her day, we tell the story, were used to doing fancy needlework, and that would be very comfortable for people coming in and seeing the women who were doing this fancy needlework, even in the midst of conversation. But when they came to see Martha Washington during the Revolutionary War, she was knitting socks for the soldiers because they really needed them in the terrible winters that they faced in places like Valley Forge.
I was fascinated that in several cases that because they were in Washington, that they were responsible for much of the beautiful scenery in Washington, including the cherry blossoms.
That's right. Many of the first ladies took on Washington as the city of Washington as a special cause. For one thing, they had to live there. For another, some of the first ladies, and you're thinking about Helen Taft.
Yes.
But this was a time when the age of Roosevelt and Taft, that America was really becoming a major player internationally. And they had the sense that it needed to be a capital that reflected that. Helen Taft had lived in Asia. Her husband was the administrator in the Philippines, and she traveled through Japan, and she was quite taken with the cherry blossoms. The story with the cherry blossoms is that there was a woman here in the city who for 25 years lobbied to bring cherry blossoms to Washington around the tidal basin and could never get the attention of authorities in Washington. She lobbied the first lady, got the first lady's ear, and Helen Taft got it done. The Japanese heard that the president and the first lady were interested in the cherry blossoms, and they made a gift of them post-haste. There is an interesting story about the cherry blossoms. I think in an effort to bring trees that were mature and flowering, the Japanese actually shipped over old trees.
Right.
And by the time they got to the States, they were filled with insects. And the president and first lady sadly had to give the order to burn all of those initial trees. Must have been really tragic after how excited they were to get them here. And they all had to be replaced, and they eventually were. It took until 1912 when Mrs. Taft actually had the ceremony for the first cherry trees, and you can still find a plaque there with some very gnarly old trees. I love to go visit them. Mm. That indicates that they were some of the original trees planted by Mrs. Taft.
It's a fascinating story in the book, and as you say, because many of the first ladies were living in Washington, they wanted to impact their landscape. When do you start to see the word power used of a first lady having power within the administration of the president, of who they are married to, and also in the nation as a whole?
I think as early as Abigail Adams.
Mm.
These women, for the most part, even if they lived in an age when it was not socially acceptable to speak publicly, always had the ear of the most powerful person in the country and later on in the world, and many of them were not shy about using it. Abigail Adams was, we see in her voluminous letters to John, not the least bit shy about expressing her opinion to him about the ways that she hoped he would affect discussions in the Continental Congress and the shaping of the founding documents. And she continued her outspokenness when she was First Lady. She was considered rather meddling, which I think is a description that we would use today for an outspoken individual, seen at that time to be meddling instead. So I think throughout the ages, women, we have more documentary evidence, certainly as time goes on, but women really understood that this was a unique position that if they chose to exercise, that they could influence their husbands, certainly, but also have some influence on the policy direction of the country.
You tell an amazing story about Mamie Eisenhower of really understanding television, the very new medium of television and its power.
Mamie Eisenhower really is quite an interesting character. Not only did she understand it, but importantly, the advisors around the president did. And Mamie became quite a popular figure. She was popular on the campaign trail. Ike would bring her back out on the trains when they were campaigning, and people would cheer, "We want Mamie." But they understood that this new medium of television, which was really just bursting onto the American scene, and also, remember, advertising people. We're all in love with Mad Men today, but that was the big age of Mad Men, and they were beginning to realize how to package these two figures in the White House, and they took advantage of the medium of television to be able to do that. They hosted a big birthday special we tell about in the book for Mamie Eisenhower months before her real birthday, but to be able to do a variety show, which was so popular at the time, all celebrating Mamie's love of pink and Mamie's love of people. She was really quite the conversationalist. She learned this from years of being the wife of a military officer and reaching out across the various constituencies she had to in that role and brought that to the White House. And she always had a smile, and she considered herself a real ambassador for the president and for the Eisenhower administration.
And now we have a first lady who is taking her second try at running for president of the United States.
Isn't that interesting? The top story of the week, huh?
Right. That really shows the evolution of the job, doesn't it?
It does. And of course, it's a role and not a job because we don't pay them. But I think there are other first ladies before Hillary Clinton who were equally politically adept, and had they lived in other times where this was an opportunity, could have considered it. I'm thinking, of course, of Eleanor Roosevelt, who stayed in public policy throughout the rest of her life out of the White House, enormously interested. I think Hillary Clinton always refers back to Eleanor Roosevelt as a guiding light for her in her own role. But Eleanor Roosevelt didn't have the opportunity to pursue politics in the same way. Certainly, she had the appointment at the UN, but running for elective office or having a cabinet position was something women really didn't do at that point. And I'm also thinking about Lady Bird Johnson as a possibility. Every bit the politico of her husband, very wise, a top advisor. She stayed interested in her own policy issues until she died in her mid-90s, but really didn't have the opportunity that today Hillary Clinton can have of seeking office.
You know, I was reminded by this. Sometimes you have things in your life that you do, and then you forget exactly what was the reason for them. But when I was a kid, I grew up, and I had a pet raccoon. And the pet raccoon's name was Rebecca. And
now
long forgotten why we had named the raccoon Rebecca. And it wasn't until I was reading the book that I realized we have Grace Coolidge to thank for my raccoon being named Rebecca.
How do you think that happened in your family, though?
Well, my mother was a reference librarian.
Oh, that's great.
I think that's how that happened.
Rebecca the raccoon is one of my favorite stories. Grace Coolidge is an interesting woman to look at because in some ways she's reflected, I think, in Laura Bush and Michelle Obama, in the fact that they recognize that anything that they do that's really controversial can impact the president's ability to get his own program passed. And so they may perhaps subjugate some of their own interests while they're in office in order to pursue that. Grace Coolidge, however, loved animals, and that was something that would not be controversial. She brought all sorts of animals into the Coolidge's life. Notoriously, Rebecca the raccoon, apparently they saved it from being dinner and made a pet of it. And the White House staff put up with it for a while until Rebecca started climbing the draperies and climbing into the White House bathtub and throwing soap bars around. And that was it. Rebecca was confined to a cage and shipped out to the countryside for the rest of her existence.
And we should also note that Grace Coolidge was a rabid Red Sox fan.
Oh, you should not use
Well, maybe rabbit and raccoon in the
right.
same
rabbit
sentence.
Rabbit and raccoon
yeah.
in the same sentence. She was a huge, not only baseball fan, but Red Sox fan, more so than the president. And she was considered the first lady of baseball in her time, regularly following her favorite team and taking the president there. She said it was the way that she could relax the president from his stress, but I think it's really because she loved the game so much.
Well, the book is endlessly fascinating, and we should note that if you missed any of the series, you can see all of it online, right?
Online, and we are also re-airing it on C-SPAN 3 starting the 19th of this month of April, and it will be on each First Lady. It gets her own week again on Sunday nights, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and it carries us all the way through until December. The shows themselves have much more, of course, than we can put in the chapters of the book. We had a video journalist visit every historic site associated with the First Lady, and all of that video is incorporated into the television programs. Between the pages of the book, we really concentrated on our two guest historians for each program. So if we have intrigued anybody in this conversation about learning more, we've got lots more detail at First Ladies on the C-SPAN website, and then you can watch the series too.
Well, it's all fascinating. The book is First Ladies, Presidential Historians on the Lives of 45 Iconic American Women by Susan Swain and C-SPAN. It's published by Public Affairs. Susan, what a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thanks for your great questions.
A great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, First Ladies, by Susan Swain, published by Public Affairs. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.